Well, good afternoon, everybody. I appreciate that warm introduction. The West Virginia School of Preaching is a very, very special place to me. I had a, and there are very, very special people here to me. I was baptized into Christ in 2000. The man who baptized me, Roger Rush, is here today, which is always great to see him. Roger and I have, I tried to keep in touch over the years. I haven't always done a good job of that, but usually whenever I roll into town, Roger will sometimes invite me over and we'll talk for a little while, and I've greatly appreciated those times. This school made such a great impact upon my life because coming here, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do something for God, but I didn't really know exactly what to do. And I came to the West Virginia School of Preaching, and I sat at the feet of men like Denver Cooper, who would say things and preach lessons that even if you were already a Christian, you would think, man, if I wasn't a Christian, I would get baptized again today, right now. You would sit at the feet of men like Emmanuel Daugherty, who write his own material for classes, which influenced me. I do the same thing today at South Logan. I try to write my own material and not rely solely on things that other men have written. Dr. Earl Edwards, who I sat in his Corinthians correspondence class at Freed Hardeman, does the same thing. And to this day, because of Terry Jones, I cannot do anything but 3 or 5 points in my sermon because of his homiletics class. I am very indebted to the West Virginia School of Preaching and to so many of you who are here, so many of the members who are here who have had such a big impact in my life and my family's life. I have a daughter now, Fiona, and we have another little one on the way. We don't know if it's a him or a her, but we know it looks like a gummy bear, so we're going with that. I am grateful to be here. I am and grateful to be able to bring such a topic as forsaken by the family from Job chapter 19. Verses 13 through 22, and I've got to stop there because if I keep going with reminiscing, I could go the whole hour just talking about these kind of things. Forsaken by family. This is a very interesting topic because of what we find Job dealing with. We find Job in Job chapter 19, in verse 13, having just spent the first 12 verses of this chapter talking about how God was his enemy, how God was at war with him, how God had besieged him. And what's so incredibly sad about that is that he's wrong. It wasn't God who had brought about these horrible things that were taking place in his life. It wasn't God that was reaching out and hurting him. It was Satan. But as happens so often in life, when we're hurt, when we're upset, when we're feeling like we don't understand what's going on, a lot of times instead of turning to God and leaning on him for strength, we turn to God and we point a finger and say, God, how could you do this to me? It's very sad. And God is an easy target, isn't he? He's supposed to be all loving. He's supposed to be all caring. He's supposed to be all kind. He's supposed to be all knowing. And yet we say, God, how could you let this happen to me? And the funny thing about it is we can no more prove that God did it than he didn't do it. It would be like to say that God's all knowing and he should have stopped something. It would be like blaming the weatherman for predicting a hurricane that's coming. You know, he knows it's coming. He's telling you it's coming. And you have to be the one to deal with it. Well, God does the same thing for us in our own lives. But let's take a look as we begin talking about this, before we get into any of that, about the background of our text here. Prior to Satan's attacks upon Job's properties, his family, his relationships, his health, the scriptures present Job as a man who has a reputation of being God-fearing. I mean, this was an upright man. This was somebody who made sacrifices for his children. This was somebody who cared about his character and his conduct. And what we see following the first meeting between God and Satan in Job chapter 1, and I encourage you to turn there and look with me in Job chapter 1, beginning at verse 6, we find out that there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and his household and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the works of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from his presence, or from the presence of the Lord. So Satan's argument is, you know, of course Job worships you. Of course Job loves you. Of course he's an upright man. You do everything for him. I mean, he has all these blessings in you. He has all this great comfort in you. But if you take away all that stuff from him, you will find out just how fast he curses you. Just how fast that enthusiasm with Job leaves. And God says, well, I'm not going to do it, but I'll tell you what. If you do it, that's fine. Only don't hurt him. You can't kill him. And man, Satan took advantage of every single opportunity that God gave him to hurt Job. Not that God was permitting Satan to go and hurt Job, but God was saying, if you're going to do it, you have the free will to do it. So if you're going to hurt him, you can do what you want to him, but I will not allow you to kill him. So the first thing we see is a Sabean raid. And we see this in Job chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, where livestock are stolen and servants are killed. Now this is bad because this is messing with Job's way of life. This is how he feeds his family. This is how he makes his money. And what we have here is this raid takes away his livestock and kills his servants. Now, servants are of course, slaves, but typically a slave-master relationship in this day was more of a relationship and less of something like you would see from a Civil War movie like The Grapes of Wrath or Gone with the Wind, something like that. They were treated almost as family in some cases. They were respected. And so these servants are killed, and the livestock has been taken. Job has got to be upset by this. Imagine being in Job's place and hearing, Job, you're not going to believe what just happened. And before really that could even sink in with Job, we find out in verse 16 that another servant comes and says, hey, fire has rained down from heaven, and it has caused the death of your sheep and the death of more of your servants. So here's Job having to deal with a raid and then having to deal with fire that rained down from heaven. Then, before Job can really even start to contemplate that, we find out about a Chaldean raid. Someone else comes and says, you're not going to believe it, but the Chaldeans came, and they stole your camels, and they killed your servants. So Job is losing servants, he's losing livestock. I mean, how much worse could it get? Well, it was about to get a lot worse. Because while Job is not even really at this point even processed this, someone comes and says, Job, your children were all eating together in this house, and a great wind came along and collapsed this house, and all 10 of them are dead. In one fell swoop, in rapid fire succession, Job loses his livestock, he loses his servants, and he loses his family. Imagine being Job. The worst day I ever had recently was my coffee pot and my car broke down in the same week. Worst day I recently had. And I'm more in the coffee pot more than the car. I mean, I love that coffee pot. It's how I got through grad school. I mean, seriously. But what we're finding out here is that this is beyond a bad day. This is an attack. It's an assault on Job because Satan wants nothing more than to be able to go to God and say, God, I told you that he would curse you. I told you that if you know, if we took away all that he had and all the comforts that he would be no servant of yours. So God and Satan meet again. Chapter 2, 1 through 6. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. So Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that man has he will give for his life, but stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. We're learning something about Satan, aren't we? We're learning something about Job, too, because God is saying, have you considered my servant Job? Despite everything you've done to him, he hasn't cursed me to my face. He hasn't turned away from me. And Job's saying, Satan's saying, okay, well, you know what? Make him sick. Hurt him. Hurt his health. Take that from him. Make people repulsed by him. Then I can almost guarantee you, I mean, you can almost hear the chiding. You know, I can guarantee you he'll curse you to your face. And so God says, well, if that's what you want to do to him, go ahead and do it. But spare his life. That was the rule that God had. God would not let him be killed. Even though we know that Satan, who we are told is a murderer and a liar from the beginning, if he is able to, will hurt people physically. Now, I don't know that he can do that today. But we know that Job has shown us that given the opportunity, if he can hurt you physically, he will do it. And obviously, he wants to hurt you spiritually. So God and Satan have met again. Now Job is struck with boils, extreme illness, and pain. And if you've ever been sick to where it hurts you, and I've seen people do this. I mean, we've lost a lot of good Christians this year. I mean, I could probably name a lot of people, but if you've seen someone who's sick and someone who's in pain, you know, you understand what they're going through. Now, Job is dealing with illness. Job is dealing with illness to the fact that we may be able to demonstrate this later, that he thinks that it's possible he might even die. He wants to die. He asks God for it. In fact, he even goes as far as to say, I don't even know why I was born. You know, if only I hadn't been born. And then we see Mrs. Job. We don't know her name, but Mrs. Job, after all this pain and illness comes upon Job, after he's lost his children, after he's lost his way of life, she says to Job, curse God and die. If there was any person that Job needed more than anyone else, it was his wife. There have been times in my life when I have leaned on my wife, and she has given me the greatest comfort and strength that I could receive. Sometimes your wife or your spouse is the only one that can help you in some cases, it seems like. Obviously, we always have God, but as far as human interaction goes, sometimes there's nothing greater than your spouse. And Job didn't even have that. We have we've done studies on grief in this country recently, in the past 15, 20, 30 years even, and we have found out that grief causes people to sometimes do things they would never normally do. Grief causes people sometimes to lash out. And so here, Job's wife is also struggling with great loss. Now, we can make the argument that maybe she was not of the same spiritual caliber that Job was, and I think that's probably correct. But we know how excruciating this grief was that they were going through. We know it from Job 1:20. So then, despite this, and despite Job's wife saying, curse God and die, despite the illness he was going through, despite losing everything, he's visited by his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And Job needed these three friends like he needed three holes in the head. He probably would have taken more boils over these three friends, because there are times when you are down and someone coming along and just kicking you when you're down, or just sort of twisting and grinding in on you, does nothing more than just to make you even more miserable. And that's exactly what was going to happen here. Instead of providing comfort to their friend, they attack Job with false accusations and bad advice in three cycles. Now, we see the cycles go from Job chapter 4 through verse 14, where Job gives a speech, then the friends give a speech. And then the second cycle, 15 through 21, Job gives a speech, his friends give a speech, and it goes like that from 22 to 27. Our text today takes place, I'm going to try this button, I may have hit the wrong one. There we go. Our text today takes place in here. Job chapter 19, during the second cycle. I almost turned this whole thing off. That would have been bad. And despite everything that Job has been facing, the most agonizing feeling of all, what made this even worse, I mean, the nail in the coffin, the straw that broke the camel's back, whatever expression you want to use, was the belief that it was God who was doing this to him. You know, there are times in my life when I've been down and I've been out, but to think that God wasn't on my side would have crushed me. To think that God was against me would have destroyed me. And here Job, despite everything he's facing, thinks God is against him. And he even says so in 19 verses 6 through 12. In fact, take a look at 19, 6 through 12. Job says, know then that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net. If I cry out concerning wrong, I am not heard. If I cry aloud, there is no justice. Verse 8, he has fenced up my way so that I cannot pass. He has set darkness in my path. He has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side and I am gone. My hope he has uprooted like a tree. He has also kindled his wrath against me, and he counts me as one of his enemies. His troops come together and build up their road against me. They encamp all around my tent. He basically thinks God is attacking him. So in Job's mind, he's lost his livelihood, he's lost his servants, he's lost his children, he's lost his wife, he's lost his health, and he's lost God. In Job's eyes, it couldn't get any worse. And the problem, the whole thing about this is that Job was wrong. He hadn't lost God. God was not his enemy, but he believed he was. So what about an examination of the text? This background is essential for us getting into this text. So let's examine the text and go through some of these verses. Job is incorrect in his conclusion in verse 12. It was not God. However, what we see is that as Job begins to break down, or as we break down Job here in verses 13 through 22, we see a parallel between the word brothers or brethren of verse 13 connected to relatives and kinsfolk of verse 14. A parallel just means we see a relationship. So in 13 it says, he has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my close friends have forgotten me. So as we begin to look through these parallels, what we find out is that Job is saying that the people who are closest to him, even his acquaintances, his friends, have failed him and have forgotten him. I mean, you find out really who your friends are really quickly when times are down and you're out on your luck. The Hebrew word that we see for brothers or brethren that's used in Job 19:13 is ach, which means one who is close to someone in a type of human relationship, or a lesser extent, something like a business treaty or a business relationship, or even just an acquaintance or a friendship. So what it seems like we're dealing with here is, and that's of course, that's according to William Mounts in his Dictionary of Old and New Testament Words. What it seems that we're dealing with here is that we may be dealing with flesh and blood relatives, but it seems that the word and the context as we're using it, because Job is building a case, continually building a case of how he is being forsaken. And he's starting with his friends. Contextually, it seems that the meaning would be more suited to his friends. It can carry the meaning of flesh and blood relatives, but as we've said, more generally, business partners and acquaintances. Now, contextually, it seems like the business partners and the acquaintances may make more sense. Now, can we be dogmatic about that and just drive a nail down and say we know absolutely for sure? No, we have to be careful about doing that. But what we can say based on the language here is that it seems very likely that Job is counting his fellow countrymen, his friends, his acquaintances, even in some cases his business partners as saying, they've left me, they've taken off, they want nothing else to do with me. Kylan DeLeach and, of course, Homer Haley share this view as well, and I submit it for your thoughts as well. No matter whom Job has in mind here in verses 13 and 14, it does not take away or detract from the emphasis that Job feels that he's been abandoned. He's been abandoned by God. He's been abandoned by his family. He's been abandoned by, it would seem here, his friends and those closest to him. And, of course, the most painful thing is that God was at fault for this. And we continue to see that sort of push or that sort of drive is the motivation behind why Job is so hurt. Those that dwell in my house, and most likely what we're dealing with is we're dealing with people whom Job is hosting. You look at verse 15, he says, those who dwell in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger. I am an alien in their sight. Now, Job obviously had maidservants dwelling in his house or female slaves, but it seems likely also that he may have had guests or sojourners staying with him as well. And we can base this on Genesis 18, 1 through 8, take a look at Genesis 18, 1 through 8, very quickly, if you would, with me. Sometimes I feel like actually going to the Word and looking at it is better than a paraphrase, even if you are trying to save time. 18, 1 through 8, the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, and he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day, so he lifted his eyes and looked, and beheld three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground and said, my Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant. Please let a little water be brought, and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts and that you may pass by inasmuch as you have come to your servant. And they said, do as you have said. So Abraham hurried to the tent to Sarah and said, quickly, make ready three measures of fine meal, knead it and make cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd, took the tender and good calf and gave it to a young man and hastened to prepare it. So hospitality is something that was done and done pretty regularly in this day and time. Job, however, may be a little bit older than what we're finding even concerning Genesis, but what we see is that certainly Job would have fallen into this, would have done the same thing, since he says in 31 verse 32, no sojourner had to lodge in the street, for I have opened my doors to the traveler. So Job's house was opened. It was open to guests. It was open to his servants. Job was a hospitable person. And yet, what we find out from verse 15, he says, they count me as a stranger. I am an alien in their sight. Well, with those boils and with that illness, Job probably would have looked pretty badly. And so those to whom he had opened his home, they treated him like a stranger. They treated him like he was unwanted in his own house. Imagine that. In your own house, you're treated like a stranger. You're treated like an outcast. Where is Job finding peace? Additionally, Job states that his maids in 1916, they also treated him in the exact same manner. He says, "I call my servant, but he gives no answer." Now, this is a very, to me, this is one of the saddest points in all of the text that we're looking at. Because if you look at 16, he says, "I call my servant, but he gives no answer. I beg him with my mouth." I mean, when I was little, I had the flu really bad. And I remember my mom, you know, I had the great idea, you know, "Mom, give me a bell like they did in the Brady Bunch, and I can ring that bell and you can come running." And she said, "No, we're not doing that. I'm not having you ringing a bell." She said, "If you're sick, just holler for me and I'll come running." So I did. And every time I yelled, "Mom, you know, I'm sick," or "Mom, I don't feel well," or "Mom, I'd like some toast," you know, whatever it was, you know, that my little 9-year-old heart wanted, Mom came running. Well, I wasn't nearly as sick as Job was, and here is Job, who is so physically ill that he's calling out for help. He's calling out for a servant. Now, we don't know why exactly for what reason he was calling out for a servant, but he needed somebody to come and help him. And what we have here goes beyond a slave-master relationship. What we see from Job here is the cruel neglect to the needs of a suffering human being. Job is sick, and Job is saying, "I need help, and you won't help me. You stay away from me like I'm some kind of outcast, like I'm going to get you sick." Job was bad off. His breath was bad. We see in 17, "My breath is offensive to my wife, and I'm repulsive to the children of my own body." I mean, that's bad, isn't it? I mean, your wife is saying, "You've lost me spiritually, you've lost me emotionally, and you've lost me physically. I'm sorry. Your breath is just too much for me." His illness was giving him bad breath. And so Job had lost his wife in all three of these senses. But we have to ask the question, who are the children of my own body? This has given some people quite a time. There's some possibilities that exist. Perhaps Job has some other children that are only mentioned here or most likely given to him by another unmentioned wife. Well, the problem with that is that Job is never mentioned in Scripture anywhere as a polygamist. So then we say, well, what about his illness? It made him go crazy. You know, some people, when they get struck with fever, they can lose their minds. Well, the problem with that is that we see Job, who demonstrates full mental capabilities when he's confronted by God in 42:1-6. Well, what about grandchildren that he longed for? Maybe he was saying, "I'm upset because I'm never going to have those grandkids that I can load up with sugar and send home with their parents." You know, well, that doesn't seem to be the case either, because just like the previous argument, there's no real textual support for this. However, Kylan DeLeach and others have posed this. They've said, the phrase "children of my own body" may be better understood as sons of his mother's womb, or in example, her who bore him, consequently of natural brethren and or brothers or sisters. If that's the case, and Job is saying that the children of my own body, or my brothers and sisters, those who are of the same flesh and blood as me, in a sibling sense, are against me even. "My breath is offensive to my wife, and I'm repulsive to my own family, or my own brothers or sisters." Then Job is making a case in this sequence. He's saying, "I have lost," in verses 13 and 14, "my friends and my acquaintances. I have lost my guests, my maidservants, and I have lost my literal flesh and blood family." You see, Job is making a case here. He's saying, "I've lost my friends. That's bad. I've lost the people of my own house. That's worse. And I've lost my family. I can't even turn to them. My breath is offensive to my own wife. The children of my own body are repulsed by me." You know, it's a sad thing that Job is dealing with, that Job is going through. And even in verse 18, we see Job who says, "Even young children despise me. I arise and they speak against me." Young children were taught in this culture to obey and respect parents. We still think that I like to think that we still teach that in this culture, although I've seen quite the opposite, you know, many times with kids just pretty much saying whatever they want to their parents. Not so in this day and time. Job was not the object, that's supposed to be not, he was not the object of disrespect. Job had people who respect him, or who did respect him. You look at 29:7-11. Now, some have speculated that maybe Job was the recipient of direct ridicule or harsh words from these children, and that's entirely possible. They may have teased him. They may have said stuff, you know, stuff that was harsh to him. We all know how kids act when you know, kids want to tease somebody. Others have speculated maybe it's not so much what they said directly to him as it is what they said of him in secret. In avoidance of him, not directly to his face, which would have amplified his feelings of being forsaken. Remember, Job is talking about, "I have been forsaken. People don't want anything to do with me." And certainly, in whatever case this was in, Job was just simply not respected anymore, not by anybody. So in 19, he returns to where he started. All my close friends abhor me, and those whom I have lost, and those whom I love, have turned against me. Right back where he started. Right back where we began. We've gone full circle. And it's possible that he is including everyone that we've talked about from 13 and 14, from 15, from 16, and from 17, all in this verse. But he's saying, everybody I've talked about, everybody I love is against me. And of course, again, this was amplified even more so by the fact that he believed God was against him. So we get to verse 20, and some people, and I, of course, very much disagree with the speculation that has surrounded this verse. Some people say Job chapter 19, verse 20 doesn't really seem like it belongs there. They say it seems like it's out of place because here Job is talking about, you know, his bones clinging to, my bones cling to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. They say, well, he's sick. Of course he's sick, but he hasn't escaped anything by the skin of his teeth. And I beg to differ. I think that this verse not only belongs here, but flows absolutely perfectly with the text. Because remember what he's doing. He's building that case. My friends have forsaken me. My maids and my servants have forsaken me. My family has forsaken me. And then he gets to verse 20. And he says, I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Well, what has he escaped? He's escaped the only thing that hasn't happened to him yet, death. This verse tells us that Job had thought about death. That it's possible that Job was thinking, I may not be long for this world. But he's saying, I'm not dead yet. I'm not gone yet. I'm sick, but I'm still here. And this transition, of course, is very natural. And I believe there's no issue with the text whatsoever. Job is essentially saying, as we get into verse 21, and again, 21 is a natural transition from 20 because he says, have pity on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. So there's an appeal here, isn't there? He's saying, look, I'm really sick. I'm extremely ill. You know everything I've lost. You know that I believe God is against me. And so if you're supposed to be my friends, if you're supposed to be here to help me, then why don't you cut me a little bit of slack because you know everything I've gone through. It seems to be that Job is appealing for a little bit of mercy here. Can't you at least back off a little bit? Instead of continually saying, surely you must have sinned for some reason, surely you must have done something wrong, if you would just repent. I've seen people do that to people. Come on, surely you did something wrong. There's no reason that anybody would treat you that way, you know, if you hadn't done something wrong. And then what we find out is hey, you know what, that person didn't do anything wrong at all. People sometimes go and they make harsh assumptions of people. Sometimes we expect the worst in people. And when we find out that we're wrong, we got to eat a little bit of crow in that situation. Job 20, 21. We're running short on time, so I'm going to hurry along here. Job had lost his health. He'd lost his friends. He'd lost his family. In his mind, though, it was God who struck him and God who was persecuting him. And Job, however, is not alone in Scripture in terms of feeling like he was forsaken, in terms of feeling like people were against him. We can look at Cain killing his brother Abel in Genesis 4, chapter 8. We can look at Jacob tricking Isaac into receiving Esau's blessing in Genesis 27. We can see Joseph being sold into slavery by his own brothers. They wanted to kill him originally, remember? But then they said, no, let's not do that. Let's sell him into slavery. Let's take his coat and we'll rub some blood on that and we'll make Jacob think that he's dead. Family, being forsaken by your own family. With Delilah's betrayal of Samson in Judges 16, 4 and 21. Absalom, who murders Amon and then incites a civil war in David's own kingdom, who ends up dying even though David tells Joab, don't kill him, don't kill him. And yet Joab, what a great general he was, kills him anyway. I mean, hey, it's just a casualty of war, right? We see Hosea dealing with an adulterous wife in Hosea 3:1. We see Judas Iscariot betraying Jesus Christ in Luke 22:48. And we see Jesus even persecuted by his own brothers in John 7:1-5 about going up to the Passover. What separates all of these instances, though, from what we're dealing with Job again, is that they did not believe that God had forsaken them and was their enemy. Job believed that with all his heart. Job couldn't have sunk any lower, and yet what we find out is that from 23 onward, it's one of the greatest statements of faith in the entire chapter. Job still believes in God. He still has faith. Even if he believed God was his enemy, he still was God and still deserved Job's faith. And it was this belief, again, that made all that just seemed to make everything worse. That just seemed to hurt him more than anything. So what about application for today? We have a few minutes left. Let's talk about some application for the church today. we should not be surprised that issues will arise in life for us, because 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12 says, yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. That's absolutely true. We see in 1 Peter 5, 8, now keep in mind what we just read from Job 1 and Job 2, where God asked Satan what he was doing, and he says, from going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth upon it. 1 Peter 5, 8 says, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And that doesn't send chills up your spine to read that and then consider what Job said in Job chapter, or what Satan said in Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 2. I don't know what will. Job is saying, hey, Satan is admitting that this is what he's doing, and Peter says that's exactly what he does. It's a scary thing to think about. And one of the greatest lies we tell ourselves is that Satan's not real. He's not really after me. If he went after Jesus in the wilderness in Matthew 4, 1 through 11, why would we think he wouldn't come after us? We're also warned about issues that we will have in life with those who are closest to us. Mark 13, 12 says, now brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. I never saw family truly forsaking one another until I went to Guyana. And I went to Guyana with a couple of people who were dear to me who passed away this year. But I learned valuable lessons from being there. One of the things that I first saw when I was in Guyana was a little boy by the name of Kevin, and he was 5 years old. And Kevin's parents decided they just didn't want him anymore. So in the middle of the night, while he was asleep, they got up, they packed up, and they left. And they left Kevin alone in this little hut. Now, Kevin, over the next several weeks, got lice, he got sores, his hair was twisted and knotted. They left him. They left him for dead, essentially. And what had to happen was the neighborhood began to give him food. And the preacher down there in Haruru, where we were staying, took him in and raises him now to this day as his own son. Wayne Sowers is the preacher's name. Being forsaken by family is a tough thing to deal with, and it happens. The other thing I saw was I was introduced to a young lady, and she was about my age at the time. I was 20 years old when I was down there, and I met her, and she left, and they said, do you realize what that girl's story is? And I said, no, I have no idea. And they said, she's been coming to these gospel meetings and to church, and you know, church services that we've been having, and she told her dad, she said, I'm thinking about becoming a Christian. And he said, I'm going to tell you right now. He said, you can go to those meetings, you can go to those services, but if you become a Christian, you will have no place in this house. So she came to the meeting that night, and she said, I know what I need to do. I need to become a Christian, but my dad is going to throw me out. And they said to her, they said, well, you do what you feel like you need to do, but your greatest responsibility in life is your soul. It's the greatest possession you have. You don't own anything in this world that is worth more than your soul. And they said, and you know you need to become a Christian. You know what you need to do. And there are people in this church. The church will take care of you. We love you. And so she became a Christian. And sure enough, she went home and her dad says, you're no daughter of mine and you have no place here. And he threw her out. And to this day, as far as to the last I heard, that girl is still a Christian and is still being taken care of by members of the church. See, Tacitus tells us that even at times during the Neronian persecution, Christians were giving up one another and ratting one another out. We get so upset and we get so moved by all this horrible stuff that we see that we think, why should we even bother? What is the point if the only thing we have is to continue to be forsaken and continue to be hurt? People have asked that question, and this is what we have to tell them. Number one, it's because Christ understands us. He says in Hebrews 2:14, therefore in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Can you imagine being able to say to God, God, you don't know what it's like to lose somebody? Yes, he does, John 3:16. God, you don't know what it's like to be me. You don't know what it's like to be hurt. You don't know what it's like, but he does. The Hebrew writer tells us in Hebrews 2, he knows exactly what it's like to be you. He knows exactly what it's like to hurt. He knows exactly what it's like to cry. He knows exactly what it's like to lose. He knows because John 1:14 says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. He lived a human life in addition to being completely divine. And in my opinion, one of the most comforting verses and talking about people who were forsaken by family, Jesus says in Mark 10, 29 and 30, so Jesus answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel's who shall not receive 100-fold now in this time houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions and in the age to come eternal life." Jesus is saying, even if your own family gives you up and forsakes you, you will receive more in this life. There are men sitting in this congregation today that I look at as father figures. My dad's not a Christian. There's some things I just can't go and talk to my own dad about. I can't go to him with spiritual questions. But there are men in this audience who I have been able to do that with over the years, who have helped me, who have guided me, and I'm indebted to you. I know this is the truth because I've seen it firsthand. I've seen it in people's lives, and I've seen it in my own life. Jesus makes this promise, and it is absolutely 100% true. Finally, this afternoon, Hebrews 13:5, it says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." No matter what we're dealing with in life, no matter how alone we feel, no matter how hard things are, you will always have Jesus Christ with you as long as you remain faithful to him. As long as you are doing, as Matthew 6:33 says, seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. We focus on the blessings of that, and all things will be added unto you. But we're missing a lot of times the fact that we have to seek his righteousness first. That's what we have to do. Hebrews 13:5 tells us he will never leave us and forsake us. The power of the book of Job is in his patience. It's in his overcoming. It's in his overcoming family issues, friendship issues, sickness, and ultimately the magnification of his faith. Job wouldn't stay that way forever. Job would ultimately see the error of his ways and that he had falsely accused God, and he would be given back everything that he had, but he never, ever, ever did curse God to his face. There was a victory for Job, even though Job may have been a little weak at some points, may have been a little hurt at some points. What a powerful lesson we get from the book of Job, and what a powerful lesson it teaches us today. No matter what, God is always with you if you are willing to be with him. I thank you so very much for your kind attention and for your being present today. Thank you very much.